الظاهرين المعصومين المظلومين ولعن الله أعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد فقد قال الله قوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ليس للإنسان إلا ما سعى. صلى الله عليه وسلم. Balancing this dunya and hereafter has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 6. As we do every single night, a quick recap of what we've discussed so far. We have done our best to understand that this dunya of ours that we live in right now cannot be ignored. In fact, we have a very beautiful hadith by Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Rasulullah says, Al-dunya dunyanan. This dunya, there are two dunyas. There are two faces to the dunya. Dunya balighan wa dunya mal'una. The dunya where you and I can attain success from, and the dunya that's cursed in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have, time and time again, heard about this dunya that's been cursed, the one that Mawla Ali gave the lock to, the one that you're asked never to hold on to, never clutch to, never place your hope into. And all these things have confused our needs, unfortunately. We simply have no idea how to live in this world. We don't know to what extent can I attain happiness in this world. Can I be a rich individual? Can I drive a nice car? Can I live in a nice home? Can I do all these things while my Ahlul Bayt tell me this dunya is a disgusting place to live in? And so what ends up happening is we have two extremes in this society, and that's been our discussion for the past 5 nights. One extreme is that extreme where individuals have completely engulfed themselves in this dunya and have neglected the hereafter. And the one extreme is that we have individuals who have engulfed themselves in the akhirah and have neglected their dunya. Both extremes are rejected by Islam. If the Ahlul Bayt always preached one thing between two extremes, it was the path down the middle. Amr Bainan, Amr Bainan. We do not neither neglect the dunya altogether nor do we neglect the akhirah altogether. In fact, we have countless traditions, and we'll look at one tomorrow, inshallah, where the Ahlul Bayt actually praise this dunya. Where we have our fifth Imam, Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salatu wasalam, advising one of his companions to not pray for a quick death. Don't ask for a quick exit from this world. Use this world to attain God's mercy. Use this world to create your witnesses like we talked about yesterday for the hereafter. So for the first 3 nights we talked about the dunya itself. Aspects that are exclusive to this world. Yesterday and the day before we talked about the hereafter. We talked about extremely important concepts like accountability, like zuhud, how to be a zahid in Islam. How to be somebody who, yes, while you gain wealth, you don't clutch to that wealth, you don't hold on to it. Such that, as I mentioned before, there are individuals who, when they leave this world, their soul separates their body so easily that if death was to come upon anybody, we would hope and pray it would come upon like this. Then there are those, unfortunately, who when they leave this world, it's like a sheet being ripped from a thorn bush. Very, very difficult does that soul detach itself from the body, and the only reason why is because we have convinced ourselves that this world is the end all of you. So as I promised today, tomorrow, and Sunday, rounding out our time here at Legal Time, we'll look at how to do the actual balancing itself. We've exhausted the dunya, we've exhausted the hereafter. We are now talking about practical tips now on how to balance these two worlds and how to remove the confusion. My youth will be surprised how much our Ahlul Bayt have preached This world is yours. Live in it. Enjoy it. But do it the halal way. Be somebody who has immense wealth, but do it the halal way. Be somebody who is showered upon risk after risk, and sustenance after sustenance, but do it the halal way. We don't cheat, we don't steal, we don't stab our nose in the back just for an extra dollar in our pocket. If we want to attain any sort of wealth in this world, we're going to do it the halal way. But one factor which is needed for us to combine these two worlds is desire. And that becomes our discussion today. Desire in Islam. We'll talk about the origin of desire in Islam. We'll talk about the reality of desire in Islam. And then we'll look at to what extent do the Ahlul Bayt teach us about desire in Islam. Are we allowed to desire those things that are worthy in front of us? If so, to what extent, inshallah? Desire, human being goes through two births in his world, in his life. We are born twice. The first birth that happens to us is from the womb of our mothers. And out comes this baby that's crying and crying and crying. And with this baby comes two very important, very powerful faculties. One is the faculty of shahwa, one is the faculty of ghazab. One is that department of desire and attraction, one is that department of anger and repulsion. And these two departments are with us from the moment that we exit the womb of our mother to the moment that we're buried in the ground 6 feet under. And as our life goes on, these two faculties get stronger and stronger and stronger. But focusing on the life initially of a two-year-old, a four-year-old, a six-year-old, you know, for those of you who have small kids in your house, they run on two engines. I want, I don't want. I desire this, I don't want this. I want to eat this, I want to wear this, I want to play here, I want to sleep at this time, I want to watch this. I don't want to eat this, I don't want to go here, I don't want to watch this, I don't want to sleep right now. Everything in the world, the pre-teenage years, is all about wants and not wants. Those things that we desire, those things that we're repelled by. They don't know anything better. So when you try to teach a child that, look, you can't have a Henry bar for breakfast, they won't understand that. If you try to teach them that, look, watching Barney 24 hours a day is not going to do anything for you, they won't understand that. And so initially what ends up happening is the first birth of any human being is accompanied by two very powerful forces. And these two very powerful forces overtake and consume that existence, that human being. And they literally live their lives like animals. They simply go on instinct. Babies do. And as that child gets older and older and older, the second birth comes out. When that child turns baligh, the second birth of the intellect now provides human being with a guide. You see, from day one that we were born, all we understood was I want this, I don't want this. We didn't have any sort of knowledge or logic or reasoning inside of us at the age of 5 or 8 or even 11 years old to understand that, look, there should be criteria of what you want and criteria of what you don't want. Where Islam says that comes about is that we become mature adults. And that maturity comes with a certain age for boys, a certain age for girls. And that is not defined only by physical appearance, my brothers. A little bit of hair, your voice changes, all of a sudden you're a man. But that intellect inside of you is where Islam says There's beluga zehni, there's beluga jismi. And that beluga jismi might be at 14, 15, but there are some people who simply don't aspire to be anything beyond somebody who is mature in terms of their body. They haven't yet reached that beluga zehni. That beluga zehni comes about when? When that faculty of the intellect now, which separates us from every other creation out there, is injected inside of us, and its sole purpose is to guide us, is to take the chazab, take the shahwa, take the wham, take the anger, the desire, and the creativity, and literally bind it up and say, look, you guys, come with me. I'll tell you where to go. That's why the word akala in Arabic literally means a rope that you use to tie things together. The job of the akal is what? The job of the intellect and the reasoning, which, like I said, separates us from every other creation, is to take these three departments that's been with us since day number one and guide them and tell them, look, you will desire what I tell you to desire. You will be repulsed by what I tell you to be repulsed by. We're not animals. We don't go based on instinct. That's why when Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wa salam, describes these very famous stages of the human being, where an individual who is completely governed by his shahwa and his ghazab is worse than animals, and one that is guided by his aqla is higher than angels. It's for this reason alone that you have the choice now. You can ignore the aqla, you can ask the aqla to guide you. But if you do not build that intellect and that reasoning inside of you, well, like I said, we are not a religion that caps that desire. We don't say that shahwa is haram. Shahwa, in fact, is a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because what ends up happening is that if you cap that shahwa, if you strip that human being from that desire, you start doing inhumane things with little boys, unfortunately. That's exactly what happens. The cardinals in the Catholic Church, the result of that was that they were asked to cap their shahwa, to remove their desire. It's a natural instinct. Don't act on it, they say. The result of it is what? Abuse and scandals and harassment, unfortunately. We are not like that. We believe in the power of ghazab. We believe in the power of anger. We believe in the power of shahwa. We say desire is a beautiful thing. It has to be guided. It has to be directed. There has to be some sort of hadi over it. It can't be left for it to control one thing inside of you. What ends up happening is that if your desire, if the faculty of your desire overtakes your aql, and you've seen it many times, that if you want something, doesn't matter if it's right for you or wrong for you, halal for you, haram for you, I simply want it, and I want it right now. That's when your inside, your eternal kingdom, your nafs, your soul, everything to do with your internal existence is governed by your shahwa. And it blinds you, completely blinds you. Imam Ali says, Al-Hawa al-Sharikul Amar. Oh. He says, desires is the partner of blindness. When the Quran describes those who are in the head and in the hellfire, the Quran says that those who are in the hellfire, aksar, the majority of them from the insan and the jinn, Allah then describes them. Who are they? لَهُمْ قُلُوبًا لَا يَفْقَهُونَ بِهَا. They have hearts, they don't understand. وَلَهُمْ أَعْيُونٌ لَا يُبْصِرُونَ بِهَا. They have eyes, they don't see. وَلَهُمْ أَذَانٌ لَا يَسْمَعُونَ بِهَا. They have ears, they don't hear anything. أُولَٰئِكَ كَالْأَنْعَامَ. They are like cattle, the Quran says. They're animals. By the home of Avalu, they are worse than animals. They are heedless individuals. They are ghafil individuals. They forget that Allah gave you that heart. Allah gave you that sight and that hearing. And you use it to what? Block yourself completely. So in one ayat it says that those who are burning in the hellfire, aksar, majority of them will be those who have given a heart, eyesight, and sound, and they never use it. Here what I'm saying that the partner of that eyesight is hawa, our desires. So there is right away an immense opportunity for us to teach ourselves to do what? To control our desires. To manage our desires. To understand where to point our desires. And nobody's asking you to not live a life of luxury, like I told you before. No one's asking you not to wear the best of clothes, not the best of cell phones, not the best of cars. You've worked hard, you've educated yourself, you work 12-hour days, you tell yourself, I've earned it, I want to live it, live it. But the problem lies when we exceed that need and we go down that path of luxury. Where we are invited to a person's home as couples, as husband and wives, for dinner. We go home and all we see is, wow, what a beautiful house they have here. And on the way home, the only discussion was, did you see how they decorated their living room, their bathroom? You see that TV? What about that car, that sofa, those dishes? Oh my God. We have to have all these things now. What do? You max out your credit card. You pay interest. You have to have it. You have it. Then what that ends up happening is that contentment that you're looking for. So you accumulate these desires and these desires. You have a beautiful house, mashallah. It has to get a little bit bigger. A very nice car, I want to drive what he drives. You have a beautiful purse, I want to have what she has. You have 3 pairs of boots, I want to have the 4th pair what she has. And our desires simply don't get full. And this is the problem. Our Ahlul Bayt teach us that within our desires is this jug inside of us, labeled desires. And we keep filling it, thinking that eventually it's going to get filled. The problem with that jug is that the more you put in it, the bigger it gets. And the bigger it gets, and the bigger it gets. And we all think, oh, I'm filling it, I'm filling it, I'm filling it. We look inside, it's still empty. It's calling out, fill me, fill me, fill me. We go up, and we go beyond our means. We fall into debt. But on top of that, we don't even get contentment from those things that we have. Because what we're looking for is for this material thing to give me that source of sukoon, that source of comfort. It's not there. What we want, my brothers and my sisters, what we want is that zarf, that jug inside of us, to be unlimited. We want to, the more that we fill it, the more we want to fill it. But the problem is that we've labeled it desire. But really what we should be doing is taking that zarf, taking that jug inside of us, and pointing it towards the one unlimited in this universe. There is nobody else who is not mahdud in this world but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The faster we realize that, the faster we are on the path to Jannah. Unless we realize that, we're going to keep filling up these wrong jugs, thinking for a moment that this is a source of my happiness. That's why we see people who have everything, they don't have contentment. That's why you see the richest of the rich, they don't sleep at night. And the poorest of the poor sleep like babies at night. Because the rich guy is worried, tomorrow, what if something happens to my riches? He tosses, he turns. The poor guy says, look, it was a pretty bad day. How bad can it get? Tomorrow, inshallah, will get better. That umid, that hope in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts him to sleep in the middle of life. So the more we realize that, the faster we'll get to our success. I was in Hyderabad 2004, 6 years ago. With my sister. I'll tell you later about how that turned out. But in Hyderabad, certain areas, at least in the old city, they have water tanks as a system. But you fill the water, and then you use that much water for your shower, for your dishes, for your cooking, etc. And the moment it starts to get empty, you fill that tank up again. So I want to describe to you for a moment, as an individual, the night before, he fills up the water tank to full. Goes to sleep, pick Neil up tomorrow, I'm gonna wake up, have a nice shower, there's lots of water in the tank. He goes home, he turns the tap on, there's nothing there. Drink, 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 drink. Because I just spilled it last night, what happened? He starts freaking out. He checks the tank, it's empty. He calls the best plumber in Hyderabad, Mir, whatever Mir. And this plumber comes in, he rips apart the entire system. Now they're panicking, the neighbors are coming with jugs of water, the family's coming with bowls of water. You have to survive with water, you have to cook, you have to shower, you have to wash yourself, everything. The plumber's going at it. Finally, they find what? A leak in one of the pipes. They fix the pipe, fill the tank, everything's back to normal. When it comes to our faith and our knowledge, we also have a tank. And every single time we sit in one of these modalities, we fill that tank up with something. Every time we read a hadith, we fill that tank with something. Every time we read a book, we fill that tank with something. The problem lies, this is the problem now, when we go in situations, in circumstances, when we want to tap into that tank, we turn that tank on, nothing comes out. What happened to our faith? What happened to our knowledge? It's not there. I know there's stuff in the tank. I just filled it. 2 months and 8 days of Muharram. There has to be something in there. 10 days of Muharram. I went from this much to this much. I picked the best alim in Toronto. I sat there. I even took notes. My tank is full. Why is that when I need that faith and knowledge, I open the tap, there's drip, drip coming out. What happened? Where is the leak? I ask you, my brothers. Where is the leak in our tank? And sometimes that leak are these things that we clutch to in this world. It creates holes inside of our pipes. And when we want to turn on that tap of faith and knowledge, of ilm and iman, there's nothing there. And we panic. And we search for here, here, give me something, here, there. There's nothing there, unfortunately. And so these types of discussions about desires in this world help us to identify the leaks in our tank. Such that if we were to fix one leak after one leak after one leak, you'll understand that the more that I fill it, when it comes time for me to tap into that tank, when I turn it, it'll come gushing out, inshallah. What's all about Allah? Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah, Allah,
the Quran talks about this as if there are individuals who have created desires to be their gods themselves. Have you seen those individuals, the Quran says? Have you seen them who take their desires to be their gods? And with this knowledge, Allah misguides them. After that, the Quran says, وَخَتَمَ عَلَىٰ سَمْعِهِ وَقَلْبِهِ. It put a seal on the ears and the hearts. وَجَعَلَ عَلَىٰ بَصَرِهِ خَيَشَحُتُ. We put a seal over the eyes such that you can't see anything. You're blind completely. But the Quran says, can anyone guide you after Allah has misguided you? The effects of this idea of taking your desires and making it your Lord, where every time your desire says, I want this, you say, yes, sir. And you run out and you get it. Whether you need it or not, whether you can afford it or not, it doesn't matter. I simply have to have it. That's where every individual in this room has to do a lot of self-accountability of yourself. Ask yourself, am I living a life of luxury such that if I was ever to be asked to pull myself away from these riches, I can do it. Like I said 2 nights ago, nobody here is going to say this was the richest dead man in cemetery. At that moment, the bones of the poor and the bones of the rich will be in one state, in one symbol. You'll be dust. You'll be nothing. Maggots will eat your body just like maggots will eat those of the fakirs. And so controlling your desire after you realize that sometimes it's not about owning that desire. Sometimes it's simply about the fact that can I have this desire or not? I want to have this thing. Can I have it or not? It becomes part of the chase, my brothers. It doesn't become part of the fact that you want to own it. That's why a lot of us and our sisters as well. When they want something, they simply want to know, can I have it or not? And they only realize that after they've owned it. They went out, they bought it, they put it on the plastic, they're paying interest now to the Jews, they have whatever they want, they don't even enjoy it. In fact, they might even be gifted to somebody else later on. I have no idea why I bought that, was there. It wasn't about that to begin with. It was about the chase. It was about that faculty inside of you that from day one you were born, asking you and telling you that, look, I've been with you since day one. And the more you feed that desire, the bigger and bigger and bigger it gets. Where it becomes completely out of control. That's why when Mawlana Ali, alayhi salatu wa salam, talks about the solution to this, he says, Ra'asul Aqal, the bunyad, the nucleus of Aqal is what? Mujahidatul Hawa. It's a mujahid against your desires. It's a soldier against your desires. It does jihad against your desires. What does the bunyad, the base and nucleus of your aqal? Of your reasoning. You can't live like animals, my brothers and my sisters. We weren't created to be like animals. It's important for us to sit there and ask ourselves very tough questions about our desires. Because again, our Holy Prophet says one desire sometimes, the effect of one desire can be a lifetime of grief. And we've seen that. Everybody here has a story. Everybody has a story, they say. Momentary lapse. When you gave into your desire, you gave into your shahwa. Years and years ago, 10, 15 years ago, you gave into your shahwa. And right now, you could be still paying for it. It was a momentary lapse that lasted a lifetime of grief, the Holy Prophet says. So let's be a little bit more careful. Let's understand that Allah has given us that blessing of the aqal, has given us the blessing of logic. And the purpose of that, like I said, is to guide the eternal kingdom. It's for that shahwa to come knocking on the door of the aqal and say, look, I desire this. I desire this person. I desire this thing. Is it okay if I get it? It's okay if I love her. It's okay if I buy it. And the other will say yes or no. That's it. Very simple. And if you think it's impossible, again, the example we have is our Ahlul Bayt. Come to the war of Khandaq. Mawla Ali is on the chest of who? Amr ibn Abdawud. On the chest, ready to finish this off. This Mal'un does what? He spits in the face of Mawla Ali. The ultimate insult of any man is to spit in his face. Our book tells us that Mawla Ali got up, went for a walk, literally came back and finished him off. When the onlookers who were anxiously looking on over by the tents, when they were watching this, they would ask Mawla Ali later on, why would you give such a giant of a man an opportunity to get up and defend himself? He said, when that mother old spit in my face, I became angry. I got up, I collected my anger, and I finished him off. Had I killed him at that moment when I was angry, I would have killed him based on my personal anger. I got up, I collected my niyat, I understood that my ghazab is fi sabilillah, and I killed Amr ibn Abdul. This idea of asking your aql to control your ghazab and your anger. That's why in hadith we have that ghazab equates into the animal which is known as a dog. And there are many, many hadiths about this. It's not my topic, but while I'm here, let me mention this. They also equate ghazab and anger to fire. And the way you put out fire is what? With water. That's why the first thing that Imam Sadiq says that when you get angry, if possible, you do wudu. Do wudu right away. Literally put water over that fire and cool yourself down. If not, then change your position. If you're sitting and you're angry, stand up. If you're standing and angry, sit down. Change your position. Allow yourself to feel like, you know what, I'm changing my environment, thus I should be changing my emotion as well. What's Allah Ta'ala Muhammad? So talking about this idea of balancing this world and the next, if we fall to the trap of these desires, of this idea of that shahwa inside of us controlling us, we simply will lose focus on the hereafter. As I mentioned before, Mullah Ali says that the one who has sold out his akhirah for his dunya, he's lost both worlds. And the one who has sold out his dunya for his akhirah, he's gained both worlds. So in this life of ours, which lasts 65, 75, if you're lucky, 100 years, make it a point to ask yourself, am I living a life such that if I was asked to detach myself from these things, can I do it? Ask yourself, am I a slave to my desires, or is my desire a slave to me? Ask yourself, am I living a life where I am doing an israf of what I have? If Allah has blessed you with wealth, does it mean to throw it away? And ask yourself, have I lost sight of the fact that everything in this world is limited? Even the bounties of this world are limited. Have I lost sight of the fact that I am completely engulfing myself in the ni'mah of this world for the sake of the ni'mah that awaits me in the hereafter? As I mentioned before, the body that you and I will be in the hereafter will not be the body of this world. The body of this world cannot for a moment accept the punishments and the blessings of the hereafter. We simply are at a too high of a level. We can't even handle the tribulations of this world through this body today. How can we handle the punishment that awaits us in the hereafter? This body sometimes can't even handle the rewards and the blessings of this world. How can it handle what awaits us in the hereafter, inshallah? So similarly, we have to keep that in mind. That's why when Mawlana Ali says, if you want to sell your nafs out, make sure it's for a price higher than Jannah. That's exactly what you do. You're selling your nafs out for something higher than Jannah. And like I said, everyone's heaven is different. Mawlana Ali's heaven was different. My heaven is different. Your heaven is different. What Mawlana Ali was striving for was nothing to do with materialistic goods. He simply wanted qurbat ila Ali. He simply wanted to be as close to Allah as possible. And that was his heaven. Whereas you and I could be shooting for, like I said, pearly gates and hoodies and milk and fruit and God knows what else. If that's the case, there's nothing wrong with that. But keep that in mind. That everything in this world is bound to be fana. So why not turn your forced face towards that existence, that world that is bound to be baqa? What's Allah Ta'ala Muhammad wa
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajil farajum.
And again, we search for role models, right? The way that we work as human beings is we have this copycat system. If we have a individual who is, let's say, successful in this part of his life, and you also want to be successful in that part of your life, you simply copy what he's doing. You have a business that's successful and you open your business in that field, you simply copy and you mirror what they're doing so you can also be successful. Similarly, in our life, we're trying to control our desires at this young age for my youth. We don't have to look anywhere else but to Karbala. Karbala for us is that darsgah, that university that gives us all sorts of lessons for all sorts of ages. If you're young, if you're old, if you're male, if you're female, if you're black or white, if you're Arab or non-Arab, it doesn't matter. This university is open to everybody. And the one class that we have when it comes to controlling our desire is the class of Abu Fadl al-Abbas. This was a man who was 33 years old in Karbala. The peak of his youth. He was chosen by Amir al-Mu'mineen for the day of Ashura. He was a giant of a man. He was a warrior. His feet were dragged by the sands when he was on his horse. And if he just had permission for a moment to fight, history would have changed. But let's see at what point and where this was Abbas. On Shab Ashur, he's sharpening his sword, they say. And the sharper his sword gets, the more fierce his face becomes. And the sharper his sword gets, the more fierce his face becomes. While doing this, in walks 4-year-old Sakina. Looks at the face of her Chacha Abbas and goes running towards Baba. Says, "Baba, there's something wrong with Chacha Abbas. His face keeps getting more fierce and fierce. Baba, I'm scared." Imam Hussein knew exactly what Abbas was doing, but he also knew that if he says anything at that moment, it'll have no effect. If one person can have any effect on Abbas, it's nobody but Zainab. He says, "Zainab, go and explain to Abbas why we're here." She walks in and she sees exactly what Sakina sees. Abbas is sharpening his sword, his face becoming more fierce. 33 years old. The son of Ali, can you imagine for a moment? Of war, the emotional atmosphere of Karbala. Take yourself there for a moment. Inside the heart of Abbas, who's listening to the sound of Al-Adash time and time again, who looks at the face of his Mawla Hussein and sees sweat and blood and tears, and he knows that if Mawla Hussein was to give me 1 second of ijazah, this would be over. Zainab walks in, says, "Abbas," there's no reply from Abbas. She says, "Abbas," there's no reply from Abbas. 3 times she says Abbas's name, there's no reply. At that moment she reminds Abbas, says, "Abbas, this is Zainab calling you." Instantly Abbas gets up and says, "Shahzadi, why did you do so much, Zainab? I would have came to you." She says, "Abbas, if I ask you for one request, will you listen to me?" He said, "Of course, Shahzadi, whatever you say, I'll do." She says, "Put away the sword, Abbas. We're not here for that. We're not here for this." Instantly, they say, "Put away the sword." Again, imagine for a moment the level of Josh in Abbas's personality. Level of Josh. But instantly, from one call, he turned that Josh into Hosh and put that sword away. But the sound of Al-Adash was echoing in his mind. He goes to Imam Hussein, "Mawla, if you're not going to give me ijazah to fight, at least give me ijazah to go and get water for these kids at least." Imam Hussein says, "You are my Alamdar, Abbas. You are the commander of my army, Abbas. You are my backbone, Abbas." At that moment, Sheikh Abbas Qumi says, and the Abbas looks around him and says, "Mawla, well, there's no army left. Who am I, the Alamdar?" The Abbas is given permission to go get water. I don't have the energy to recite the whole Shahadah. I will say this, and this is enough for us. That when he got the water, he made his way back to the Khaymah. As many arrows as hit him, he bardashed it. He was patient. He was patient. From one arrow that hit the musk of Sakina, at that moment he stopped the horse and turned that horse around and said, "I'm not going back to the Khaymah without a drop of water." At that moment, Khurmala shoots an arrow that hits the forehead of Hazrat Abbas. I mentioned to you yesterday, and this is enough for us, like I said. Ayatollah Naimi narrates But when I read the Musibat of Abul Fazl and Abbas that night, Janabi Fatima Zahra came in my dream. And she's crying and she's crying and she's crying. And he said, Shahzad, did I do something wrong? Did I recite the Musibat wrong? Did I do injustice to Abul Fazl and Abbas? Why are you crying like this? Do something. The Fatima says that Naini understand. Every single time you read the Musibat of Abbas, make sure that those who are sitting there are listening understand that when someone falls from a horse, they first put their arms down to break the fall. My Abbas didn't have arms to break the fall. He simply fell on that arrow that shot from the arm. My Abbas didn't have arms. Salaam alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh, God, he shot.